welcome to the special pre-recorded USA Rugby Happy Hour Live episode, or I should call it the Happy Hour Recorded episode. I am Bill Baker of Eagles Overseas, joined here by Rugby Morning's John Fitzpatrick. John, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's an historic day for USA Rugby. Very exciting.
Oh, man, so pumped. Unless you've been living under or hiding under a rock or, you know, off the grid hiking in the Andes, you've no doubt heard the amazing news today. World Rugby has announced USA Rugby as host of the 2031-33 Rugby World Cups. Big exciting news, and we are pumped because with us today to talk about this incredible news is USA Rugby CEO Ross Young and USA Rugby World Cup bid chair Jim Brown. Gentlemen, welcome. We cannot thank you enough for joining us on this monumental day.
Cheers, gentlemen. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
And where are we today? I think, Ross, you're in Dublin. Jim, where are you?
I'm in Park City, Utah.
Wow, we got you all over the world.
Yeah, no, so don't worry, I'm struggling with the glare of the sunshine in normal Dublin day, so we're all good.
Well, hopefully they're in the care package for this event. There was sunscreen. Who knows?
inevitable here.
I'm sure you're itching to get off to a pub to celebrate or something, so let's get into it. First, either Jim or Ross, jump in here. Congratulations for submitting a successful bid to the 31-33 Rugby World Cups. Would you guys consider this, a sigh of relief?
There's definitely a bunch of mixed emotions. I think obviously huge excitement around the potential that we've been talking about for a number of years. Yes, there's a big sigh of relief as well, because you never quite know until it's validated. And there's also, you know, a bit of fear and trepidation, because we've made some bold claims, I think perfectly justifiable claims, but there's no place to hide now in delivering it. And, you know, I'll let Jim dive in on some of the additional elements around his interactions and excitement around some of the cities and host venues as well. But just collectively huge, but yeah, a number of mixed emotions thrown through the body currently.
And Jim, you know, obviously there's a lot of weight in you guys' shoulders getting this done. How about yourself? I mean, you got to be feeling really good right now.
Yeah, I think Ross said it very well. I think it's mixed emotions. It's, the reality is we were quite confident that we provided something that World Rugby would be very interested in. And quite frankly, as we got to the final stages, it felt like World Rugby wanted this as much as we wanted it, to be honest. And I think that was the nature of the relationship we had with World Rugby, is we were always, I wouldn't say always, but certainly last 4 or 5 months, we've been on the same page and working to the same goal. That being said, as Ross said, obviously we're very excited, but trepidation is a really good word. I mean, I got texts this morning from beginning at 5 a.m. from the East Coast onwards from some of the larger stadiums in the country, and getting into a formal agreement and getting them up to speed in terms of what this means. I think they get it, but certainly there's details in there that we have to relay to them in the next 3-4 years and really make sure that everybody's remains excited and engaged and will deliver what we expect to be a great product. But the difference between great and not so great is at least from today's perspective, could be rather thin. and we have to just make sure we manage it correctly and do right by them and right by the country and right by everybody in the broader sports world of the country.
And Ross, over the past few years, you've led USA Rugby out of bankruptcy and through COVID, some difficult times, and now preparing for 2 Rugby World Cups. You know, how would you describe the current mood within USA Rugby?
It's been the proverbial roller coaster, isn't it? As you said, there's been a number. When I first came on board, you know, it was really to help out with the operational delivery of World Rugby event and the Sevens in San Francisco in 2018. And there were huge highs and huge positives around hosting that event, but it had a financial impact on the union. You know, the structures that we went through, but I think the underlying emotion for everyone is the fact that is one of opportunity. And I think that's the biggest thing, is we've learned a number of lessons. You know, I've said publicly, I've made a couple of mistakes. I think USA Rugby as an NGB, was it fit for purpose? You know, going through bankruptcy, we had to cut away a lot of the organizational structure and try and simplify things. And we've cleaned out a lot of areas, and you know, that was tough. And now, you know, the optimism, as I've said, and we have the opportunity now to build something really special, hosting these two major events. It's not just about, in fact, I think it's more about what we can do in place between now and the actual hosting of them. Jim and his team have proven the technical stroke operational capabilities are almost the easy part. It's engagement, it's playing numbers, it's, you know, more boys and girls, it's aspirational stories, it's all those things putting together that we've got to put together in the right way. And now build something that is not just about a one-off. It's about, you know, putting proper firm foundations in place that we can, that we can utilize in hosting this event that really gives the sport longevity and pulls it into the mainstream within the US market.
Jim, you've been the executive director of competitions at FIFA for the 2006 and 2010 Football World Cups, right? So no stranger at bidding for and running big events. But how did the bid process for this World Cups compare to some of the other sports?
I think, I was involved in the 2026 bid for the Soccer World Cup. So I think there were a lot of common elements. Certainly the requirements were very, very similar, from stadiums to host cities to, you know, government guarantees and those kind of mechanical things. Which we were able to really, I think, use what we did in 2017 and 2018 in this process. But I think, as I'm often saying, that there's a couple of pieces. One is the relationship with World Rugby, and I think Ross really carried a lot of that burden to ensure that, you know, we were in lockstep with them and really formed what I would call a partnership almost from day one. I think they got a sense that we knew what we were doing. They got a sense that we had a process in mind, which I think helped their efforts to manage all these bidders. So I think that was very positive. And then I think another, and remains the case, I think we talk about providing a bid to a certain extent. We've started the organizing process, which was really well supported by World Rugby. I think the other arm, which Ross touched on, and I think he talked about the bankruptcy. I was on the USA Rugby board at the time, and that was a daunting piece of challenge to deal with as we embarked on this. But also the pandemic, I have to say, made it a very different experience for anything I've done before. I mean, there's a certain extent we, as a bid team, didn't really meet more than maybe once or twice formally face-to-face at all. And I would give Ross a lot of credit for, and the board, as we maneuvered through the last year and a half or so. The other unique challenge, I think, was the skepticism that came to a certain extent from the rugby community within the United States. The sense that they couldn't believe this could happen. They didn't believe we had the capacity to do that as a country. And watching that momentum shift slowly to really the excitement that we're experiencing today. And anytime we had a positive step in the process, there was excitement. But I think that's a piece of the bid process that obviously didn't really sit on our shoulders, but sat on the USA Rugby side more so. But the real challenges of getting people to understand that this could happen, and now that it's here, we have to be ready to deal with those challenges.
Talking specifically about the U.S. bid, what were some of the selling points? Was it the potential broadcast partners, the mass amounts of stadium options, the opportunity? What was really attractive to World Rugby about the U.S. bid?
Well, maybe Ross can answer that. I'll do my quick perspective is I think the resources and what the country can offer from a sporting landscape was really, and once we were able to turn those pieces around, and it wasn't hard, I have to say. I think the stadiums and the cities were really excited and you know, not necessarily aware of what was coming, but they definitely understood the sport, they understood the potential. and really like the approach, as we like to say every time we have formal meetings with those groups. You know, the partnership really starts with World Rugby, USA Rugby, and our bid, and that translated to the cities and the stadiums. And I think that, I'd say, communal element, which one can say is really the nature of the sport, I think really got them engaged. And World Rugby, it doesn't take a really high experienced person to understand the potential that this country can offer if in the sports growth and financial, but also in just the visibility. And having gone through it in soccer back in the 90s, when I would work for 94, I obviously could relate to everybody the vast potential I feel that this can offer just from that perspective as well.
Yeah, I think just to follow on what Jim said, is that we went from the start to make a very layered approach. I think it's very easy to talk about, you know, the shiny things that might be the outcomes from it. But again, from some of the lessons we learned previously, we want to make sure we went into everything with our eyes wide open. So even before we entered into formal discussions with World Rugby, we did our own internal, which again, Jim led with a small board, our own internal feasibility study. And then that gave us the ability to start laying the building blocks, if you like, for that first part of the argument is, you know, can it actually be delivered? You know? And that's not just great venues, because we know there's some fantastic venues, but some of them are not fit for purpose because they're too narrow. You know, you can't be playing a Rugby World Cup, the premier event, with a pitch that's 20 yards too narrow. So there are minimum requirements as part of that process. And I think getting those technical sides done first, and then laying on, you know, the more tangible potentials around pure size and capacity. And that's for both 31 and 33. You know, how do we raise the bar for both? How do we break records for both with regard to attendance? And then, you know, how do we, the last stage was really, you know, how do we then make it happen? And, you know, you look at various different ticketing strategies, sales strategies, elasticity pricing for ticketing pricing. And so it's not difficult, but what we didn't really get carried away about the intangibles first was really make that case on something that we had the data and information to back up on, and get them excited. And then, as you say, get them engaged in that partnership approach that Jim talked about to ensure that they bought into the bigger picture. And I think we're also fortunate that during this process, tied in really well with what they were doing strategically, they as being World Rugby as a business and an organization, about how they operate from a day-to-day perspective, and taking more control, if you like, doing more self-funding and you know, separating, if you like, the revenue-generating side of what World Rugby does, from some of the, which are essential, the core corporate governance part. So I think that helped everyone in this overall discussions as well.
Ross, you mentioned the, you know, the stadiums and requirements. You know, there was a comprehensive list of cities and stadiums that were part of the proposal. Even MetLife Stadium tweeted out today they're excited to be involved in all this. When you mentioned World Rugby's minimum requirements, obviously field size is a big deal. What were the other requirements involved with these stadiums? Because this, obviously, the United States has plenty of facilities to use, depending on your sport. FIFA 2026 obviously has their own stadiums they're dealing with. But what are we talking about requirements? You know, seat amounts, ticket sales amounts, size of stadium, location. What other requirements do they have?
I can send you this through. It's extensive. Yeah. Jim, why don't you have a first go as you sort of at that, and I'll dive in if I need to.
Yeah, I think the primary thing, obviously, is we're delivering a sport, and the sport requirements were the challenge, as they are with the FIFA World Cup, and really we spent a lot of time, and I think the backbreaker will be and is the field dimensions. I think the other areas I think are documented, but I think if we don't meet them, we exceed them. There are elements of a decision, a choice that World Rugby will have to make with regards to say, media locations and seating areas. But, you know, in those cases, you know, they have a requirement for a number of seats, which in most cases we exceed quite easily. But, you know, often in our big stadiums, MetLife being one, the media seats are not in the center of the field, which, you know, and having done a few big events myself, I don't think that's as vital as comfort and, you know, operational access, et cetera. So, and World Rugby is quite flexible in that regard and supportive as well. So we feel that our challenge was really on the sports side. You know, installing rugby goalposts may seem like an easy thing to do, but having done it for other sports, I think it's not as easy to put in those, and they'll do it, but oftentimes it involves pretty thick concrete to get those things into the ground. But I think those little pieces are things that we have to do with field dimension by far being the number one thing, and obviously the expected FIFA World Cup announcement of their sites, I think will impact our process as well, because it guarantees to a certain extent that those fields will meet rugby requirements as well.
This is probably an obvious follow-up question, but fans are probably wondering, you know, when announcements may roll out about what cities will host any matches and where the final can be held. Any idea when we might be able to hear some of that news?
There's a couple of things we've got to do first, and I think that's because we've got this longer runway for 31 and 33, and as Jim alluded to, we asked for expressions of interest for hosting both the events. And we've got a great slate of potential cities. I think it's important that that process remains competitive in the immediate future. But you know, we also need to work out things like tournament format. Traditionally, you know, the women's was a smaller World Cup that's increasing in size. There's talk of the men's going to 24 teams. There's talk of varying pools, if you like. Again, rugby traditionally had an odd number of teams in it, so four pools of five, which causes bye weeks for certain teams and player welfare issues, etc. So I think that, you know, and the other is how the tournament is going to be based. So we have some major strategic elements, because we could certainly place pools, whether it's four or six pools in different areas of the country, and sort of fix them for the pool phases and have quarterfinals and semifinals. Or, you know, Jim and the team have done a bunch of work in, do we start on the west side of the country and get huge engagement and almost flow the tournament across to the east coast, and, you know, allow touring fans to see a bit of part of everything. There are, you know, again, that's one of the benefits of hosting in the US, is there's a number of ways that we can operate and deliver this, and we want to keep everyone engaged for as long as possible. And the plan will be, as tends to be historical, that the final locking in of venues, because there may be another new venue come online between now and then, is we're not going to make commitments now. We're going to keep it competitive until we know what we get. And then generally an announcement of cities and venues comes as you sort of get into the start of that new cycle. So, you know, 5-4 years out. And then you can make a buzz when you do that handover from the previous host to the new one around some of those details. But, you know, we've got numerous options. And I think that's something else which, you know, no other country delivers, is there are multiple huge cities with huge populations and great venues that we can pick from.
This is to Ross or Jim. You mentioned some of the big stakeholders, certainly Major League Rugby, a big stakeholder in all of this. What do you see as their role over the next couple of years in terms of helping provide support for the Rugby World Cups?
They're key on a number of fronts. I think as the platform for the men's game, them along with the WPL and expanding that and looking at options of what we do with the WPL. I think I mentioned previously again, the NCAA, the collegiate structure. I think building a planning aligning. I think, you know, the NLR has taken great steps. They've been hugely supportive. during this whole process. But we do have to define exactly, you know, exactly how to maximize their opportunity. And that's, you know, that comes in a couple of ways. One, you know, one is they have a much wider footprint and spread in geographies that around the US from a day-to-day perspective. So engagement with community programs and grassroots programs, there's already initiatives that, you know, we've helped with them aligning with the youth and high school section of USA Rugby, you know, with flag rugby in a box in schools around the MLR areas, etc. So I think there's that overall engagement side, and then there's, you know, the high performance and playing side, which is important, is, you know, how do we raise the bar of the levels of rugby within the MLR? How do we create more opportunities for American qualified players to be playing in the MLR? You know, and even from a mid to long term perspective, how do we create the environment to bring more of the overseas US players, which is now not just the men, we've got 22 women playing in the Allianz Premiership in the UK and very successfully. You know, how do we get them back? Because I'm convinced we'll be much more successful as we have our stars playing in this country in regular competition year in, year out, than it is currently with them playing in predominantly European-paced competitions. So there's, yeah, there's a massive role to play. The details of those we have to work through.
So, gentlemen, one more question before we let you go, either to Jim, I don't know if you can go back to skiing, or Ross, back to the pub, but more interviews, I know. Actually, Jim, I'll go to you with this one. There are some big events coming up in the States over the next 10-plus years. You got the 26th FIFA World Cup, you got the 28th Summer Olympics in L.A., and now also bids for the Winter Olympics in 2030-2034, and now the Rugby World Cups. Do we run a risk of maybe the Rugby World Cup getting lost a bit with these other huge, big events, or is this something that you can do all together and also learn from those events?
The answer, and this is based on going to the market and talking to all these stakeholders, is I don't think so, or we don't think so. I think whether it's broadcasters or sponsors or the stadiums, 99% of the discussions we have tell us that the sequence of events over the next 10 years or plus now with 2033 is only viewed as a positive by everybody. I mean, of course, there's some market saturation and there's some perhaps fatigue from the cities like LA, but quite frankly, LA is probably one of the most excited when it comes to hosting potential Rugby World Cups. And not only, and I think the sequence of the events is they're equally excited about men's and women's, we haven't had any sign of that, and there is discussion amongst the events that, you know, there's ways to leverage it so it's a positive for everybody, and if cities plan it right and know in advance what's going to happen, I think they feel like it's an advantage to them. And obviously they're all in business, in the event business, so I think they'll manage that very well. So the answer from our standpoint is no, I don't think it'll be lost. In fact, if we build it the right way, it could peak exactly where we want it to for 31, and then obviously the ultimate being 33 and a great result there for women's rugby.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for giving us this time. We're honored to have you two on here talking about this, such a monumental day. And as fans of the game, we're proud of what you two and your groups have put together for this and made this happen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure. And so looking forward to a lot more of these as we build over the next 10, 11 years.
Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Nice to meet you.